Let's do a show.
Oh, there it is. There it is. Look, I can see Drew through the glass, and he was nodding off, but then he started. Anyway, hey everybody, it's Kai. No, he wasn't nodding off. It's early in the morning. Hey, it's Kai. I'm back, and Molly's here as well. She has been here the whole time. Tuesday, our deep dive show, single topic, making us all smart about something that is, oh by the way, in the news: the tax code in this country, and what it has to do with basically everything.
Is it? Is that in the news? I didn't even notice.
In the news, yes.
I didn't even notice. A little bit. Yes, in the biggest font I have ever seen in the New York Times app, the tax code is in the news. Over the weekend, obviously, the New York Times reported that President Trump paid only $750 in federal income tax in each of the years 2016 and 2017. As far as we know, despite that being, you know, less than a lot of middle-class Americans pay. I've seen people posting things that they pay more for than $750, including, like, car registration, yeah. You know? Yeah. But as far as we know, he was largely following the law. Or at least the law allows for this kind of thing. Even though this was sort of, like, less than even most rich people pay when they're following the law, there are a lot of things in the tax code that allow some people to pay a lot less and that contribute to the kind of ongoing theme that we keep having on the show, which is inequality in this country.
Yeah. You can avoid taxes. You may not evade taxes, I think, is the legal definition. Anyway, so we have Chai-Ching Huang on the phone with us. She is a senior director of economic policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, their federal fiscal policy team. Chai-Ching, thanks so much for coming on.
Great to be here.
Let me ask you your first gut reaction when you read this story in the New York Times, these stories, because they are trickling out day by day. What'd you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think this, as you said, there's two sort of big questions that they raise. The first is, what does the tax code actually allow in these sorts of circumstances? To facilitate behavior where really wealthy people who have high incomes are able to not pay much in federal income tax. And then the second question is, well, maybe some of these things really aren't allowed by the tax code, but the state of tax enforcement hasn't caught up necessarily with all of the taxes that are owed and should be paid on time.
Mm-hmm. So, and then from your perspective, does that and has U.S. tax policy kind of always favored the wealthy?
Yeah, so I mean, I think we've seen some big steps in recent history that have made the federal tax code less progressive. I mean, overall, it is important to note that the federal tax code is modestly progressive, and that means on average, higher income people pay a greater share of their income in tax than low and middle income people. Again, that's on average. That means that the tax system modestly shrinks inequalities in after-tax income and wealth. And the investments that it funds too, if they're well targeted in areas that help boost opportunity and mobility, that can also shrink inequality. But that comes with a lot of really big qualifications, including some of the recent changes to the tax code. One of the biggest qualifications is that the US tax system overall is really quite small compared to other developed economies. That means it raises a lot less revenue overall as a share of the economy. So even if it's progressive, that means its impact on inequality is limited by its size. And you can also sort of see that in the fact that the US has much lower levels of public investment in things like childcare and paid leave and other sorts of investments that other developed countries have. And you asked about the sort of historical trend. Well, US revenues as a share of the economy are at historically low levels. They've been eroded over recent decades by policy changes, including the 2017 tax law that cost $1.9 trillion over 10 years.
It is so fascinating that the US tax code and tax receipts, I suppose is the word, are small as a percentage of this economy, because then, of course, it makes sense that we underinvest in things like infrastructure and childcare and education and all that stuff. And you wonder why people wonder about that. I guess my question coming out of that is, even if it is small, how desperately do we mistreat the lower end of the income spectrum? Because, look, the rich get away with stuff that poor people just can't.
Yeah. I mean, and that sort of brings into play another big important thing to note, which is that, you know, low-income people, a lot of the taxes that they pay are from state tax codes, which are overall regressive. They pay a greater share of their income in taxes than higher-income people. So when you put the two things together, overall the tax system in the US is only very modestly progressive. And then there's two additional things that you that allow high-income people to sort of have advantages that low-income people don't. First, there's lots of provisions within the code that increase inequality. So there's tax breaks on income from assets and businesses and so on that overwhelmingly go to people who are already high income and wealth. And actually, it's really interesting to pause on that one because a lot of that income is never counted by the tax code or the statistics that are used to assess what taxes people pay as a share of their income. So there's actually recent research that says if you do try to count that income of the wealthy, the tax code looks a lot less progressive than a lot of the statistics we're used to seeing. Mm-hmm. And then there's the fact that, you know, the tax code on paper isn't necessarily what people experience in real life. Low-income people might miss out on tax credits that they're entitled to if they don't file for tax. One really recent example that's a big deal is that the economic stimulus payments, many people, some 9 million people appear to be eligible for those payments but haven't yet filed for them. So you actually need to sort of think about the administration of things that run through the tax code and the IRS to think about how people experience things in real life. And then at the other end, high-income people are really disproportionately responsible for unpaid taxes. Each year, about $400 billion in tax that isn't owed doesn't get paid. And, you know, of that, about 61% of the taxes that are unreported come from the top 10% of people, and about 28% from the top 1%. So when the IRS is underfunded and unable to enforce the tax code, the biggest beneficiaries are high-income tax cheats.
Right. So to put a fine point on it, you're saying that the tax code as written may be modestly progressive. The tax code as enacted is substantially unfair. Yeah.
Right. And that goes back to that on average piece as well. I mean, there are some high-income people that pay substantial taxes and do so with a sense of civic duty and pride and are not looking for extra tax benefits and to have their advisors push the line. And there are others that are really willing to try to push the line to see whether on audit they can stall or overwhelm the underfunded IRS. And to try to sort of settle in ways that sort of keeps pushing that line further and further in favor of lower taxes for them. So there's that means there's inequalities even within income groups.
This is going to sound like a naive question, but how problematic is it that the tax code has become so politicized in this country?
Look, I think one problem for tax enforcement overall is, you know, the statistics show, the surveys show that overwhelmingly Americans are proud to pay their taxes. They regard it as a civic duty. The thing that really, really is frustrating is when they think that other people are taking advantage of the tax code or cheating it in ways that they can't. And that goes for low and moderate income people that can't get tax benefits on their income from work that very high income people can get on their income from wealth. But it also goes for businesses that, you know, recognize that they rely on infrastructure and an educated workforce that taxes pay for, and are frustrated by their competitors that are using tax avoidance and offshore offshore profit shifting and all sorts of fancy complex schemes, basically as a competitive advantage. There are lots of business people that don't want to have to think about taxes as a way that they need to compete against against other businesses and would rather just focus on, you know, actually building a product, selling it, and customers and so forth. So the extent to which it becomes more broadly thought or accepted that many people are cheating the tax code, that creates a real problem for the idea that people will voluntarily comply and pay their taxes.
Right. I mean, I know that every system will have cheats, right? Every system will have games attached to it. But let's go back to that compliance piece, because that seems to be the sort of chronic underfunding and ability to force compliance with an existing tax code seems to be the biggest missing piece. Is that fair?
Yeah. I think the thing about this piece of the puzzle is that it is a newer piece. This is something that has emerged. You know, there's always been problems with tax enforcement, but since 2010, there's been a real gutting of IRS enforcement funding. The enforcement budget is down by more than 20% since 2010 in real terms. Enforcement personnel, the people that audit returns, are down by more than a third. The overall audit rate has fallen by, you know, 45%. And, you know, because the most experienced staff are the ones that are needed to audit the really highly complicated finances of high-income people and large corporations, it's audit rates for corporations and millionaires that are down the most. So audit rates for the largest corporations have gone down by 50% since 2010, and audit rates for millionaires are down by 61%. So that's a real problem in terms of both the direct recoveries from tax cheats that audits lead to, but also the sense more broadly that maybe it's worthwhile to just sort of push the boundaries a little bit because the chances of getting caught aren't quite as high anymore.
So if the head of the Senate Finance Committee and the House Ways and Means Committee or whoever has jurisdiction came to you and said, listen, we are going to revamp the American Tax Code and the Internal Revenue Service. Mm-hmm. What are like the three things you would tell them they had to do to make it more progressive, more equitable, and more effective, really?
Right. That's a – wow.
Just three things.
Only three.
I'm gonna cheat a little and offer three buckets of things.
All right.
I mean, so I think I think sort of raising progressive revenues in ways that close differences between the treatment of different kinds of incomes gives you sort of a double bang for the buck. You raise revenues progressively. But you also reduce the incentive for people to reclassify their income to get it into the lower rates. And the preferences for income from wealth, so assets going up in value, inheritances from business income, from art, all of those things tend to be taxed at lower rates than income from work. So there is a lot that could be done in that space that would both raise revenues progressively and make the tax code more efficient and sort of invite less avoidance. A second bucket of things is I think, you know, quite obviously rebuilding the IRS. And that means primarily building back its funding to at least 2010 real levels, and then probably beyond that, to take into account that the economy and the number of people that file for tax have actually grown since 2010. But we also need to refund them in a way so that the resource that we're adding back to the IRS goes to enforcement where the dollars are disappearing, which is at the high end, large corporations, wealthy people, international tax avoidance. And that means giving them additional tools to be able to see what's going on with those filers, better information reporting, for example, mm-hmm. And also, ensuring that as that's added back, the audit rates don't just increase for low and moderate income people more than those at the top. And then I think I'm allowed one more bucket.
Yep.
I think you're taking a bucket, but okay, sure.
I did used to be a tax lawyer, so I know fair, how to work
enough.
The loopholes.
Fair enough.
Exactly. Uh-huh.
So I think, there are a number of places where we went in the wrong direction quite recently that should be reversed in the 2017 tax law. Mm-hmm. And they were places that, in addition to just giving outright large tax cuts to wealthy people, created complex rules where there are not clear answers in any given case. And that's just, there are actually tax accountants and lawyers that have said at conferences that this has been a bonanza for tax advisors, because where things are not clear, it's really an invitation to sort of try to argue for the position that lowers taxes and invite the IRS to come and try and stop you. So one particular example is this is a big tax cut for so-called pass-through businesses. That's a little bit of jargon, but what really happens with those businesses is income from the business gets reported on an individual tax return and faces individual tax rates rather than the corporate tax rate. Someone that's been in the news recently has hundreds of those businesses. But the tax cut was not only, you know, very skewed to the top. About 61% of the tax cut goes to the top 1%. But the rules that put it in place are really sort of complicated, don't really have any underlying theory. Some of them are very opaque. So there's not really any good rules of thumb to say sort of when something is allowed and not allowed. And that's why one tax advisor told another one of these conferences that this is a giant hole in the tax code and advisors should be loading their clients' income up into trucks and driving it through that hole. and that is not a good thing for tax integrity. And it is not a good thing for economic growth or for inequality or for any of the other things that you might think that good tax policy should be trying to achieve.
Well, that was a tad discouraging way to end that, but okay. Okay, that's fine. Chaching Huang, she is the Senior Director of Economic Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Thank you so much for your expertise and your insights. This was, I totally learned something, which is cool.
Yeah, I'm so glad. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Good but discouraging.
Good but discouraging. I was reading some facts and figures earlier today about this idea of the tax gap, the kind of, you know, the difference between the taxes that the IRS actually collects and the difference in what is owed. Mm-hmm. And there's recent research from, among others, former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers estimating, I'm reading from Vox, that the tax gap will total $7.5 trillion from 2020 to 2029. So when we're having conversations...
$7 trillion.
Exactly. When we're having conversations in this country about why, you know, teachers get paid so little or why the roads and bridges are crumbling or why we don't have enough money for firefighters or social services, like, that's it. It's all right there.
Also, not for nothing, but just to give a nod to the events of this evening and the first presidential debate, which is happening Tuesday night. As we tape this, Joe Biden has just released his 2019 tax returns ahead of the debate. I'm just saying, a little politicking going on with the politics of the tax code. Anyway.
Yeah. No, this is, I mean, we could clearly do a series. We could probably do a fascinatingly fun podcast just on the new tax law. I mean, that part of it is fascinating all by itself. But we also, I mean, this is such an interesting question, right? Because I think the question with any large disclosure at this point in our landscape is, will anyone care?
Right.
I can tell you that CPAs care. We got a voicemail from a listener who is in a position to be mad, and she is. Here we go.
Hi, Kai and Molly. This is Megan from Kalamazoo, Michigan. I just finished reading the article in the New York Times on Donald Trump's taxes. And as my grandpa would say, I'm just so mad I could spit. For context, I am a CPA working at a firm that specializes in tax prep for small to medium-sized businesses. One of the many things that makes me mad is that the audit of his requested refund of $72.9 million has taken over 10 years and isn't done yet. I would bet money that part of the reason it's taken so long is the chronic underfunding of the IRS, which is a favorite soapbox rant of mine. Don't people, read government officials, understand that every dollar invested in the IRS returns $4? That's one heck of an ROI, so why is it underfunded?
Great question.
That was like the one, $1 in enforcement returns $4, and it's been gutted, and it just consistently, even like thanks Obama under the Obama administration, like what is happening? I mean, and then you get kind of annoyed about it when you think about who benefits when the IRS is underfunded, and then you stop talking because it's time for a break. Before we go, though, Kimberly and I yesterday on the program got yelled at. We got yelled at after the program. Yesterday we were talking about this story. I mean, I'm just saying, guys, the tone. on Twitter. There was the story, obviously, about taxes. We said something about refunds that apparently was not clear, which is that many Americans do not pay taxes don't have to pay at the end of the year because they get a refund. People wrote to us and said that the refund means the money was overpaid. I would also like to say there are many Americans who are just too poor to not have an individual federal tax liability. And I think that there may have been some confusion about what we meant when we said that. So I just wanted to take this moment to clarify.
Always good. Always good.
Yep. Yes. So send us your comments. Email us, makemesmart@marketplace.org. I guess you can tweet us, but honestly, maybe it's just not the best way to communicate these days. Everyone's so mad on Twitter.
So mad.
Voice memos welcome. We'll be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
All right, we're back.
We are.
Time for the news fix. Kai, I'm so excited that you're back.
I'm glad to be back.
You sound
too.
I'm refreshed. Way peppier.
I'm peppier. I mean, the grind, man. We all know the grind. It just wears you down.
Yeah.
So I, as I've said before on this podcast, without actually doing it, self-care is important. So do it. You know, I'm learning my lesson.
Good job.
Took me till I was 100 years old to figure it out, but you know, whatever. Whatever. Yes. Okay, news. Let's see. I'm first in the rundown, so I'm going first. Mm-hmm. Here, mm-hmm. Holy cow, this is actually a bigger story than I think people really understand. I saw this floating around on Twitter yesterday. People in New York, specifically Brooklyn, opening their absentee ballot envelopes and finding misaddressed return envelopes, misaddressed ballots inside, all kinds of problems. God. In the borough of Brooklyn, which has, according to the New York Times, 2.6 million people in it, of which some percentage are, in theory, registered voters. And come on, man. This mm-hmm. is not the time to be not doing mail-in balloting correctly. It's just not.
Wow.
It's bananas.
A printing error has left voters scrambling for answers and could undermine their confidence. I mean, confidence is everything, and I don't know a single person who feels confident in this process
I was out running this morning. Sorry. I was out running this morning, and I saw a ballot drop-off box, and I was like, that's where I'm going. I'm dropping mine off. Mm-hmm. Not mailing nothing. Mm-hmm. Fill it out and drop it off.
I know. Same.
Yeah.
I was talking to my mom about the same thing. She was like, I'm obviously, you know, she's like, I'm at risk. I'm not going to stand in line, but I'm going to the drop-off box. Yeah. She literally, like, it was like a go bag situation. She's like, I've already planned my route to the drop-off box. Yeah. I voted by mail for years, and I literally always forget to mail it in. And so then on election day, I always end up taking it to the polling place and dropping it off there, because you can skip the line to go to that drop-off box. And also then you get your sticker. So if you feel comfortable about that.
I should tell you the whole, I mean, and I think I've said this before, I'm a big believer in in-person voting. And let me just clarify, everybody should have the day off. We should invest in election infrastructure and we should have all of that stuff. But assuming we could get there, I believe the communal experience of voting together in a democracy has value. So it's killing me a little bit to vote by mail, but I'm voting by mail.
Yeah.
That's where I am.
Yep. I just am like looking at the story and just absolutely flummoxed and flabbergasted. And I was actually looking because earlier I retweeted earlier today a Washington Post story that I'm trying to find about how evidently individual postal workers are just like defying orders.
Yeah. Yeah.
To try to keep the post office running. They are not, they're refused. Mechanics in New York aren't removing mail sorters. Ohio clerks are rescuing prescriptions from stalled bins and delivering them off hours. Carriers are making excuses in Pennsylvania to buy time to finish their routes. I mean, the post office story, it, you know, things come fast and furious these days. And that story has not stopped, has not gone away.
For sure.
Yeah. I think, I don't know. I think we can end there. This one just made me mad.
Oh, all right. Ooh, man. You can tell she's upset.
I mean, I guess
we're not doing any more news. Just move
along. We're just not even doing any more news.
Move it along.
Enough. Just enough. Let's let you guys talk, shall we?
Mailbag.
Hello, Molly and Kai.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
Boom.
Love it. Love the new sting. Love our engineers. We turn now to an issue dear and near and dear to my heart. Not the post office, not, you know, systemic inequality, but Costco. Last week,
Costco.
We asked you, turns out you're not alone.
Yeah.
And neither am I. We asked you to send us your stories about Costco. You did not disappoint. Here is a montage.
Hey, Molly and Kai in absentia. My name is Amanda Sage, and I'm calling from Columbus, Ohio.
Hey, Molly and Amy. This is Greg from Washington, D.C.
Hi, Kai and Molly. This is Francesca from Bellingham.
Hi, this is Phil.
And this is Liz, and we're from Richmond, Virginia, and we wanted to share our Costco hot dog story.
Wow.
I want to echo my love of Costco.
Costco's been my guilty pleasure for about a decade, and I live up where people, like, despise shopping and big corporations.
Molly, you are dead on. It is the best date night around, especially in these decadent times.
It is.
I met my darling boyfriend in the middle of the pandemic, and there aren't a lot of options for spending time together and going out. So we have a fairly ritual trip to Costco. We go and visit the bacon aisle and get our weekly ration of bacon, since you can only buy one package at a time, and, you know, hit the little restaurant on the way out and get the requisite soda, because it is the best value in town. So I'm with you on the overall cost value and romantic value of a good trip to Costco.
That's a new relationship.
So after reading the story, my wife reminded me about how the first meal out of the hospital after our second child was born was a Costco hot dog.
We were discharged from the hospital after my C-section and needed to pick up prescriptions at Costco. So I stayed in the car while Phil got medicines and some food. Even though I always get the hot dog, I asked for cheese pizza instead.
Apparently, I also wanted pizza, but instead ordered a hot dog, thinking Liz would really want that. When I brought the food back to the car where our three-day-old son was sleeping, she took one look at the hot dog and asked for that instead. Thanks, Kaya, Molly, and everybody else. We love your show.
There you go.
See, it's romantic.
Oh, man.
I love it.
Oh,
Kai, while you were gone,
yes,
I'll forgive you if you didn't get caught up, but we talked about how the reason the cost of the Costco hot dog and soda has stayed the same for like 30 years or whatever is because even though they came and presented a business rationale, I think the CEO at the time was like, if you raise the price, I'll effing kill you. Work it out.
Yes, I'm sure that's what it was. Totally.
And then I confessed that my boyfriend and I literally go on dates to Costco. It's like we get all excited and we buy pizza and a little salad and a screw top bottle of wine and then we go have a picnic for dinner.
Oh, Molly.
It's so great. It's really good living.
All right. So moving on. A submission from a listener to join our Make Me Smart drinking game that we do on Fridays. Ben Vickers from Cave Creek, Arizona sent us this. Had a lull at work and put together this little game of Make Me Smart platitude bingo. Thought you'd get a kick out of it. You guys rock. Keep up the great work. Don't be downers. And illegitimus non carborundum. That's not real Latin, but don't let the bastards get you down. It'll all be okay. And then there's an image that goes with this that you kind of have to check out. Tony will put it on the show page. It is unbelievable. It's just so, so cool. Trust me.
It really is. We almost are going to need people to record themselves getting bingo.
Yeah.
And because, yeah, it turns out I've got nothing today.
This is what's really funny is, I mean,
it's so perfect.
You read this and you're like, wow, you guys listen really closely, don't you?
I know. And also it's a little embarrassing because we might repeat ourselves like a lot.
Oh,
I've got
terrible.
Two. That's one of them.
This
Ding.
Is terrible. Oh my.
Yeah, this
goodness.
Is embarrassing. We might need it. We got it. We're in a rut. We got to shake it up a little bit or not.
All right.
Because
yeah.
I know you guys want to win at bingo. So
you guys have to check this
keep
out.
Doing what
just,
we,
just trust me. You get a laugh out of it if you're a regular listener. That's all I'm saying. That's all I'm saying.
It is remarkable. Yes. Speaking of our regular listeners, this next voice memo is from a listener who has been following along with our pumpkin spice beer fundraising campaign.
My.
You know, some other stations and shows you may listen to might just have tote bags and, you know, your basic fall fundraising drive. Not us. No, no. All right, let's get to the voicemail.
This is Marvin Ramirez from Redondo Beach, California. I'm hedging my bet that you will achieve your investment goal and Kai will soon be choking down a mouthful of pumpkin spice IPA.
I will.
I would love to commiserate with Kai's pay up and join him with my own bottle. The problem is that I am having trouble finding any. Does anyone on your team know where I might locate some?
Oh, man.
Costco? Just kidding. I don't know.
Probably, but I don't need 9 gallons of freaking pumpkin spice beer. One very small
look
bottle.
Look at Twitter. Like,
I know. Look at my Twitter.
Our replies on Twitter are full. I am astonished and frankly horrified at how many pumpkin and pumpkin spice beers are. There are out there. Yeah. Marvin, however, was correct. I'm glad he didn't short our market. Not only did we hit the $100,000 by Monday morning, 4 days early, we increased the goal to $150,000 and said, oh, well, if we hit that by October 1st, I'll also have to drink the pumpkin spice beer.
So here's what's happening. Either all y'all really love Marketplace and make me smart, or you are just bad people who want to see me and Molly suffer. Because it turns out 2,400 listeners have donated a little bit more than $150,000 toward this excellent cause. The excellent cause, of course, being Marketplace and make me smart, not me and Molly suffering through what's going to be really disgusting beer. So it's been a week. We've hit the goal. We're going to find our beers. I've gotten a bunch of recommendations in my Twitter replies. I know Molly has as well. Marketplace probably has on its feed. There's a lot of them. And look, number one, thank you. Number two, this is serious business, especially right now. I mean, it's all fun and games as I turn purple drinking a pumpkin spiced beer. But this is all about listeners and how valuable we are to you. Just as a service, not as amusement and entertainment. So thank you. That's really it. That's it.
Yeah, we are sincerely grateful. Thanks so much. And, you know.
Keep giving.
I don't know. Here we go, I guess. And it's beer time.
Beer time. and oh, by the way, you can still give if you want to. And obviously, we'd appreciate it. Marketplace.org/givesmart is the website. And you can also add to that tally. There are a bunch of favors. I believe the biggest and best one, I personally believe, is the Kai PA glass, of which I have one. I'm waiting on the other one in the mail so I can have a matching set. We got coasters. We got the whole smash.
There are coasters, and the coasters are delightful. That is at any amount. It only will cost you $7 a month or more to get the Kai PA glass. And if you really think this beer thing is horrific, then you can now contribute with a clear conscience knowing that we are on the hook. But seriously, I mean, I think we raised like $52,000 in like 29 hours.
Yeah.
So really, you hate us. No, thank you is what.
Maybe we hate you. I don't know. All right. Oh, my goodness. Anyway, so we will end the way we always end the Make Me Smart question. Molly, this one's for you. I still don't really understand, but you're going to be excited when I tell you this. It's from Adrian of Yoga with Adrian fame. You and Bridget Bonner, who I'm sure is listening. Here you go.
I am dying right now.
I am Adrian from Yoga with Adrian.
Yoga with Adrian.
And I'm answering the Make Me Smart question. Something
like,
I thought I knew that I later found out I was wrong about is, well, 10 years ago, I thought I knew what loving and caring for myself looked like. But I was wrong. Just yesterday, I thought I knew what self-love and self-care looked like. But I was wrong. Self-care is actually a process. The process in which you get to know yourself, and what that looks like is always changing in relation to who you are and where you are each and every new day. To keep showing up and checking in regularly is to know and care for thyself. It's how we really learn to fully love.
Namaste.
I am just about to bawl. I am bawling I'm screaming inside my heart from both excitement and the wonder of that answer. Adrian is so great.
Was that Rose? Did Bridget do that? Who did that?
Oh, that is incredible. Also, congrats to Rose for that incredible montage. It was discussed in the Slack about who put that together. I can't believe you guys got Adrian. I'm so excited. I'm literally going to go do yoga. Literally is on the bingo card, by the way. Going to go do yoga directly after this. You guys are going to have to add yoga. Oh my God, that's so great. I love our show. I love ourselves so much. I'm just fangirling like crazy. Okay, that's it for today's show. Also, what a great answer. Mm-hmm. Every single day you get a new chance to love yourself and take care of yourself. Incredible. Don't forget to send your questions for tomorrow, because it is going to be what do you want to know Wednesday, to makemesmart@marketplace.org, subject line questions. We'll see you then.
All right, here we go. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Rose Conlon. Marissa Cabrera joins us this week. First week on the job. Marissa, so good to have you on. Tony Wagner does digital things for us. Ben Hethcote does video. Ethan Peretz does, of course, everything. Erica Phillips writes our newsletters and our smart speaker skills.
Today's program was engineered by Drew Jostad and mixed by Garrett Lang. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. The senior producer is Bridget Bodner. The executive director of On Demand is Satara Nieves.
What are we going to do when Ethan leaves? Because the new intern, whoever it is, those are big shoes, man.
Perish the thought. There will never be a new intern.
Interns grow up and they leave home, and it's okay to be sad, but you know.
Oh, but I want to smother him in the nest forever.
Can't do it.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.